Morning, we press on with Darwin's Black Box. We'll be attempting to cover chapters 4 and 5 this morning. Chapter 4, dealing with the blood coagulation cascade, and chapter 5, dealing with the systems involved in terms of protein synthesis and transport within the cell. So with that, we'll go ahead and jump right into chapter 4 on page 1 of your handout there. And the diagram that I have is a little bit different than the diagram that Behe provides within the book, but hopefully it will still get the message across. The key point here is not that we would learn what the different components are of the blood coagulation cascade, but really just to appreciate the complexity of the system, what's required for the system to function. And so I guess one of the first things to really sort of appreciate that can easily get glossed over as you're thinking about blood, because it just sort of happens, is, blood, for all intents and purposes, is a liquid. And most containers that house a liquid, if there's a leak in that container will continue to leak until the liquid is all gone. Fortunately, God has created and designed our blood so that that doesn't happen. So if we get a paper cut, we don't continue to bleed, assuming we don't have an issue in any of the clotting factors. Within a very short period of time, that cut will clot and the wound will heal before we lose all of the blood. And because it happens so automatically, without thought, we don't have any conscious thought of it, it can easily get glossed over. But that's an amazing property, and it's intrinsic to the blood, right? There's nothing that we need to, I got a cut, I need to take something to make sure that clots. These factors are all within the blood and take action without our conscious thought about them. And so what's involved in this is a cascade. That's why when you look at that figure, you see a large number of different components with arrows pointing in various different ways. And I'll try and highlight the key points that we want to focus on. And if you're really curious, I included a table that has the various descriptions of the different factors, and describing what the function is. And if you're curious, it gives the concentration in the plasma, as well as the half-life, which is essentially, you can just think of how long a particular protein would stick around normally in the blood before it gets degraded. So what's going on in that figure? The cascade involves most of these factors, these different Roman numerals, all represent a different factor. Most of them are proteins, not all, but most of them are proteins. And most of those proteins are actually enzymes that activate the next protein in the cascade. And you can tell the difference between an activated protein and an inactive protein by that in the figure by looking for the letter A. The little letter A means that that's an active protein, an active enzyme, rather. Active means that it is able to do its function. So these proteins exist normally in an inactive form, and the different terms for it, but they're sitting around but not participating in the cascade until activated. And the way this generally, there's various ways it can happen. Sometimes the binding site is covered by a different portion of the protein. Physically. Yeah, it can be a physical hindrance. Sometimes it can just be a conformational change. There's various ways that these things can become activated, but it's essentially, you can think of it as having a key for a lock that's inside a case. Until you remove the case, the key isn't going to do you much good to unlock the door. Does that make some sense? So the key thing for blood clotting, where we need to get to, is down at the bottom where it says cross-linked fibrin clot, which is composed of, if you follow that, trace that back, that arrow drawn from fibrin, which is a particular protein, it's the monomer. These things, monomers of fibrin, will actually self-aggregate and actually form long fibers, but it requires that enzyme next to the arrow, that 13A, to actually begin cross-linking the different fibers together to create the meshwork that will actually stop and hold up red blood cells and actually form a stable clot. So that fibrin is generated from a precursor, an inactive form, fibrinogen. That's done through the action of a protein called thrombin, which itself is activated from the inactive prothrombin through the various activities of the proteins above. So the cascade is all about getting to an activated thrombin molecule enzyme, which converts the fibrinogen to a fibrin. The fibrinogen does not self-associate. It does not form these fibers. It's only when it's in the form of fibrin. So the thrombin clips a portion of the fibrinogen, the molecule protein becomes fibrin, which self-associates, and an additional enzyme starts to bundle these different fibers together to create an actual meshwork. And with that, I think I'll jump into the video at this point. And as you're following along, it doesn't go through the whole entire cascade, which I think is just fine. You'll notice it essentially starts, if you look like the top middle, the factor 8, it essentially starts there and works its way down through to thrombin and down to fibrin. And it just gives, rather than me trying to describe it, gives a little bit of a picture. Granted, it's a cartoon, but hopefully gives a little bit of a picture of the different interactions that are involved to get to the fibrin. Factor 8, that's where we're starting. Ooh, sorry. Let me try and find the volume. I don't know. Do you know how to get this thing louder? Ooh. Thank you. Right in the middle of your diagram. So certainly not the entire cascade, but hopefully enough to give you a picture of the different elements that are involved in terms of getting to that actual clot. Now, importantly, as with any biological process, it's not just the ability to do the function. It's all about the control of that function. So you can imagine if you generate a clot the wrong time, the wrong place, it's going to be problematic. If you never remove the clot, then it will always be there and will start to cause issues. So there needs to also, in addition to the actual function in terms of being able to cross-link this fibrin into this meshwork, you need to have mechanisms in place to limit it to a particular location, as well as eventually, and timing is important, to actually clear that clot once healing has actually taken place. Which Behe spends a little bit of time in the book describing. I don't have that specifically called out here in the diagram on the handout, which just is really just an attempt to make it a little bit simpler. But want to call your attention to it. It's not just about getting the ability to clot through these various factors. It's also about having the control to limit where the clot is formed, how much is formed, and how long it stays. You remove the clot too early, healing may not have taken place, and undo all the benefits of the clot in the first place. You remove it too late, it could be there too long and actually cause damage as well. And of course, there are, with any number of these factors, there are inheritable diseases associated with defects in each one of these factors that can impact either the ability to form clots in the first place, or remove them once they're formed. So that's the treetop version of Behe's treetop version of the coagulation cascade. But I think it's important to remember, because when we look at something like this, based on our worldview and our presuppositions, we look at this and we marvel at God's creation, that how fascinating and wonderful and marvelous this all is. Evolutionists come at it with this type of presupposition, just minus God, right? So they don't look at this complicated arrangement and cascade as a hindrance to their theory. And I think it's important to remember that. They don't look at this and say, oh, oof, you got me. They're very comfortable with the fact that nature selected these various factors and built this up solely over billions of years. So how do they get around it? there's a couple of observations that they've made. One is that there's what's called homology, homo meaning the same, and with that homology between different proteins that are produced. And homology really is you're talking about having similar sequence of the protein. So remember, proteins are made up of individual amino acids. So that's the sequence that we're talking about, the sequence of amino acids. There are numerous proteins that have very similar, although not identical, amino acid sequences. And there's also the fact that, particularly in eukaryotes, which would include us, genes occur in multiple pieces or sections of DNA. So you don't have a gene, you know, have DNA here. You don't have the gene start here and end here. Interestingly enough, it begins here. You'll have a section of other DNA. You'll have another piece of the gene here, some more DNA, another piece of the gene over here. So you get the gene split out. So for an evolutionist, then, this process must have involved, in terms of generating all these different factors, which do have quite a bit of sequence homology, that it must have involved gene duplication and then shuffling various things to moving around of those different segments to generate these different proteins with different functions. That's how you can quickly arrive at these different numbers of proteins with distinct functions that can give rise to some sort of a cascade like this. That can start out simply enough, because there are organisms that don't contain all of these factors, but that can be built up over time to become more and more complicated. However, as Behe points out, random duplication and recombination of the correct gene pieces would require a significant amount of luck. And that's oftentimes glossed over to a large extent by evolutionists. And he gives a quick calculation in pages 93-94. If you consider there's for an animal that has this blood clotting cascade, there's usually typical animal cell would have about 10,000 genes. If you consider that those genes might be split over an average of three different pieces, you have 30,000 gene pieces, individual gene pieces. The odds of producing a specific four-domain protein is 30,000 raised to the fourth power, which is 8.1 times 10 to the 17th. It's a lot of zeros, and that's just one. That's one of the proteins. And the fact is that that's actually being generous, because there's other factors in play besides just random shuffling that would actually come into play in a biological environment as well. So you'll hear evolutionists present various facts about, you know, the similarities between proteins and the fact that you know, even proteins from, you know, some of the proteins sequences from factors in the blood cascade have similarities to proteins outside the cascade that have nothing to do with the blood cascade. They'll use that as, see, that proves that there was likely those proteins came from one gene sometime early on that was duplicated, and then now those two have diverged through the accumulation of different mutations over time and have now each filled their own unique niche within through the process of natural selection, which fits well with their worldview, right? That they take that as fact. It's happened. they feel they don't really need to prove it. They look at it and say, it happened. Just like we look at a cell and say, that's created. Right? It's a very similar, absolutely. And I think we need to recognize that right from the beginning and always remember that. The key thing is they gloss over a lot of these details. You know, the statistics involved in terms of the probability of getting these random, an emphasis on random, undirected, it's a very important part of their theory, getting these things to come together to form anything that would be actually useful. And then within a cascade like this, a key question, paraphrasing Behe here, you generate a new protein that eventually becomes part of this cascade. What's it doing when the other elements of the cascade aren't there yet? If it's not doing anything, how is it something that nature can select? How is it providing any type of advantage upon which natural selection can operate in order to propagate said new protein? It's a key question that gets glossed over in a lot of the so-called detailed explanations of, because this cascade has been around for a long time, and still is not a stumbling block to evolutionists.
They're not asking all of this to appear in human beings as we know them. It's in the previous stage of evolution that we don't know a whole lot about, so how do we know that wasn't doing something? Because, again, you know, it's there now, so it must have done something to get there.
Right. And so they, and that's part of the reason why they need time. Time is a given, right? They need millions and billions of years for all this to get sorted out. The details that need to be worked out, even from a simpler system that may still exist today, how do you, through simple, single mutations and small changes, go from a simple system to something like this, with all these different factors? Because if you start to clot too much, you create an issue, right? If you have something that might clot a little bit, but then has an enhancement that actually starts to clip fibrinogen much like thrombin does, unless you have the proteins involved in terms of clearing it, it's not going to help the organism. So you need to have these things in play at the same time in order for this to function. And these details will often get overlooked by evolutionists. And that's what Behe is trying to point out, is the level of hand-waving explanations, even in the technical research journals and articles targeted at an audience that would fully understand these pathways. So with that, I'd like to, if you turn over to the next page, we'll jump into chapter 5. And again, I would encourage you to if you haven't picked up the book, to pick up the book, because Behe really does do a much better and more thorough job than I am of diving into these topics. But at any rate, on we go to chapter 5. And in chapter 5, he's talking about the processes involved in terms of protein synthesis and transport within the cell. And the diagram there is a diagram of a typical animal cell, in which you can see, and I specifically found one that really calls out a lot of details. You have multiple different compartments and various things within the cell that all carry out specific functions, which is interesting in and of itself. But you can kind of look at it, and it's almost like a miniature city, if you will. And the different compartments are like different buildings. And Behe frames the chapter through an analogy of what we do when we ship a package from one address to another and the things that are involved, and makes the case that there are, just like where we use the post office and we have, you know, a particular address that we write on there, that there are mechanisms in place in our world that allow that transport to take place in a very specific manner. Those same things that happen in our world on a level that we can see happen on the subcellular level, on the molecular level, with protein synthesis. So, briefly, to the right of the diagram, the different steps that are involved in for protein expression and delivery to the lysosome. And the lysosome is just a particular compartment that you can think of it as the recycling center of the cell. Things go there to get broken down, and the various components get reused by the cell, and some of the energy contained within the gets reused and all that sort of thing. But there are particular enzymes involved in breaking those things down. So the cell needs to have a way of getting the information from the nucleus, from the DNA, where for the particular enzyme, needs to get that information translated into a protein, and that protein needs to get to the lysosome in order to do its work. So it begins with, in the nucleus, with DNA, the coding, the gene coding for the protein, for the enzyme, gets translated into a messenger RNA molecule, which then leaves the nucleus and moves into the cytoplasm, where a ribosome begins to take that mRNA message and translate it into a protein. But critically, it doesn't translate the whole thing. It starts and then pauses, because it needs to get to the endoplasmic reticulum and Golgi apparatus in order to complete the protein synthesis and get appropriately processed so that it gets transported and delivered specifically to the lysosome. Because, of course, just like the lysosome, all these other compartments have their specific proteins that are involved in whatever function that particular organelle is doing. So all of these aspects are involved with all of these proteins, depending on where they end up. And some of them remain within the cell, within a particular organelle. Some of them are completely excreted from the cell altogether. But all the same sorts of mechanisms and things are involved. So with that, I'd like to just run through a couple of quick videos. One is just talking a little bit more specifically on that DNA to getting to a protein. And then the next one will be the things that are involved in terms of recognizing when that protein actually needs to move from the cytoplasm into the endoplasmic reticulum. So this is just how we get protein.
Basic unit of all living tissue. In most human cells, there is a structure called the nucleus. The nucleus contains the genome. In humans, the genome is split between 23 pairs of chromosomes. Each chromosome contains long strands of DNA. tightly packaged around proteins called histones. Within the DNA are sections called genes. These genes contain the instructions for making proteins. When a gene is switched on, an enzyme called RNA polymerase attaches to the start of a gene. It moves along the DNA, making a strand of messenger RNA out of three bases in the nucleus. The DNA code determines the order in which the three bases are added to the messenger RNA. This process is called transcription. Before the messenger RNA can be used as a template for the production of proteins, it needs to be processed. This involves removing and adding sections of RNA. The messenger RNA then moves out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm. Protein factories in the cytoplasm, called ribosomes, bind to the messenger RNA. The ribosome reads the code in the messenger RNA to produce a chain made up of amino acids. There are 20 different types of amino acid. Transfer RNA molecules carry the amino acids to the ribosome. The messenger RNA is read three bases at a time. As each triplet is read, a transfer RNA delivers the corresponding amino acid. This is added to a growing chain of amino acids. Once the last amino acid has been added, the chain folds to a complex 3D shape to form the protein.
So that was just a translation of a protein, an example of one that would just stay right in the cytoplasm, right, just outside the nucleus and stay in there. And there are plenty of proteins that need to do that. So not all proteins need to get further processed within the ER and Golgi. But this is a good representation of the steps that are involved from once we have that mRNA and it begins to get translated, how it gets recognized that it needs to get further processed.
All protein synthesis in eukaryotes begins in the cytosol, where ribosomal subunits come together and begin translating an mRNA near its 5' end. Soon after the protein starts to emerge from the ribosome, it may become directed to the endoplasmic reticulum, or ER. It is targeted to the ER if it is ultimately destined for incorporation into the ER, the Golgi apparatus, lysosomes, or plasma membrane, or if it is destined for secretion. In mammalian cells, most proteins enter the ER co-translationally. These proteins have an amino acid sequence called a signal sequence, which is typically located at the amino terminus of the polypeptide chain. Signal sequences span about 20 amino acids and include a stretch of hydrophobic amino acids preceded by a basic amino acid. As the signal sequence emerges from the ribosome, it is recognized and bound by a signal recognition particle, or SRP, consisting of 6 polypeptides and a small cytoplasmic RNA. The SRP binds the ribosome as well as the signal sequence, and in so doing, stalls translation. The SRP targets the entire complex to the rough endoplasmic reticulum by binding to an SRP receptor on the membrane of the ER. GTP molecules bind to the SRP and the SRP receptor. The GTP binding triggers the transfer of the signal sequence from the SRP to a membrane channel called a translocon. Hydrolysis of GTP to GDP leads to the dissociation of SRP from both the receptor and the ribosome mRNA complex. Transfer of the ribosome mRNA complex to the translocon allows the signal sequence to interact with short hydrophobic side chains located in the narrow neck of the translocon channel. This interaction opens the translocon by moving the plug away from the translocon channel. As translocation proceeds, the signal sequence is cleaved by signal peptidase, and the polypeptide is released into the lumen of the ER. Thus, the process of protein synthesis directly drives the transfer of the long polypeptide chain through the transcription and the ER.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Neither could I. That's why I showed the video. Optical warning. Lights come back on. So, hopefully that just gave you a sense for the level of specificity and complexity involved in these particular processes. You know, each one of those, and it's a cartoon, and they do draw, you know, little nooks and things in there, and it's really trying to get at the picture that these are very specific interactions, which can get easily glossed over when you're just looking at text, that, okay, this interacts with that, and interacts with that, okay, yeah, yeah. These are very, very specific interactions. So what Behe talks about, and I tried to just sort of sum up what these different components are and how then it would be could be considered his framework irreducibly complex for gated transportation. So we have these different compartments, these organelles within the cell that are separate, right? But at times you need to get things into and out of them, and that's done through this gated transport. And what components would you need to have? You need to have an identification tag, not tagay, or whatever I wrote there. Right? You need to have an identification tag, a scanner, something that can recognize that tag, and then the gate itself, which needs to be activated by whatever it is that's identifying the tag in the first place. And that's whether you're talking about in a cellular environment, looking at moving the mRNA to the cytoplasm, the protein into the ER, or whether you're talking about badging into a building, you know, with an employee ID badge. Without any one of these components, the system does not work. And if the system does not work, you're not transporting mRNA out of the nucleus. You're not getting protein into or out of the endoplasmic reticulum, et cetera, et cetera. Gets even more interesting and complicated with transporting components with vesicles, which are, which I didn't spend a lot of time or didn't really go over in the videos, but once it's in the endoplasmic reticulum, it gets further processed, works through, and then gets further work completed through the Golgi complex before moving on to the lysozyme. And the various components there, and he uses an analogy of truck transporting diplomats' cars into a parking garage. How he came to that analogy, I don't know, but that's what he came with. So so there's six components in this type of system. One, you need to have some sort of an identification tag on the cars to identify whether it's a diplomat's car or not. You need to have a truck that can carry the cars. You need to have a scanner on the truck that recognizes the difference between a diplomat and a non-diplomat car. The truck itself needs to have some sort of a identification tag. And then at the parking garage, there needs to be a scanner that recognizes that identification tag. And then that scanner needs to be involved in some sort of a gate at the garage. And of course, on the cellular level, there are the corresponding components listed there. He goes into a little bit of detail. I don't want to spend the time in class to describe it, especially because we don't have the time. But it's not particularly important other than to recognize that these components, although they're on a very small scale, it's the same concept. If you remove any one of these things, the transportation mechanism system breaks down. So the challenge then is, how does this transport system develop step by step? What good does a signal do if there's nothing that can read it? What good does a signal recognition protein do if there's no signal? What good does a signal do, even if you have something that can recognize it, if it doesn't get removed? All these things are a challenge to step slow, gradual evolution. Any comments or questions?
Use human ability to reason as a template for understanding everything. And mm-hmm. because we can look at something like this and say, well, I don't actually know what that part does, they then seem to assume that nature doesn't need to know right off the bat either. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, that is a perfect little factory just set up to do exactly what it does, but since we don't necessarily know everything that it does, it doesn't necessarily have to know everything it's doing either.
No.
Seems to be a philosophy that's
right.
Sort of in line with that is they end up attributing to the creation attributes of the creator, right? You know, the famous line from Jurassic Park, he finds a way.
Yep.
Right? You know, so somehow they end up attributing planning and design or something or intention to, you know, what seems to be a blind process, because that's the way, you know, because that's the way it actually is. We don't want to attribute
say it
to the living God, right. They have to attribute it to something else. So,
right.
Because we as humans can throw something together with rather slipshod and we don't want to go up or assume that nature is doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So that they're in the midst of the mysterious, and they have not seen part that they're going to accept.
Oh, yeah. They're willing to accept that we may not understand exactly how this all came together or evolved. You know, I don't have the step-by-step, but I know it did. Absolutely. Right. Unguided. Unguided. That's a key thing.
If you had all of these components, the identification tags, the cars themselves, the truck, the scanner, the gate, all of them statically in place, it still wouldn't work. It requires the intelligent operation of the process. Let's run the scanner on this car to see if it complies.
Sure.
That type of thing. So you have the doctrine of creation,
mm-hmm.
but also the doctrine of providence. This stuff all wouldn't work, glorious though it is. It wouldn't work if God stepped back and disassociated himself with it. His sort of ongoing superintendence of all this stuff
yeah.
is what makes him go.
That's absolutely, that's an excellent point. And I think it's an interesting